Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hi there, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah.
I'm actually very excited to talk to our next guest, our guest today, a gentleman named Alan Brown. We came to our attention really because of this wonderful article he wrote on the foods of Kyoto in Japan that we saw in Gourmet magazine. And he's a very interesting guy. He went to Japan on a Fulbright, lived there for a long time, has written a lot about Japan. And I was struck by the cultural differences he points to in his article. And it got me to thinking about different ways that American restaurants are not what they – how whenever you look at an ethnic cuisine in an American restaurant, it is of necessity filtered through the lens of the immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's your our restaurant, Captain Lombardi, which is not Italian cuisine. I mean, that's an extreme example. That's Italian-American cuisine. That's a cuisine that was – adapted in Brooklyn in the 1940s and 50s and 30s.
Yeah, I guess for me, yes, that's and I love those kinds of restaurants. I truly do. But where I see those types of restaurants go astray, where they go awry, is when it's a kind of a filter.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, it's fake.
It's fake.
Like
and
all those all those commercials on TV where they open up the jar of spaghetti sauce and say, "That's Italian." No, it's not. No, it's not Italian at all.
Grandma hardly ever went. Pop with the jar, you
that's,
know.
That's Ohio.
That's
okay, that is not Italian.
But pizza quick sauce, there ain't no such thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Yeah, please understand that. And, you know, buying the frozen dough and unfortunately, that's how a lot of restaurants work. And I'll speak to Italian because it's the easiest one to talk about.
Because you're Italian.
But, you know, your Chinese restaurant where all the egg rolls that are made for your mainstream Chinese restaurants across the country come in giant frozen boxes and are mailed to you from wherever.
It's funny.
To talk about Italian restaurants for a second. Cannolis. Okay, Francis and I were looking for cannolis. So we were trying to find a place that sold cannolis. There's, you know, the lowest number of cannoli shells we could find by not building our own, I think, was 288 cannoli shells.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to buy a giant box of cannoli shells if you want to sell 8 cannolis a day for the next, you know, 150 days.
And the reason we were doing that was we wanted to start with a little bit of training wheels at Captain Lombardi mm-hmm. while we got our
we were wanted to practice. Yeah. I mean, that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to practice.
And then we just made it wrong.
And then we said, okay, practice is over. We figured it all out. Because I want to serve you cannoli shells that were made 700 miles from my restaurant and were made 6.5 weeks before you ate them.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but that seems to be where so many of these, and we'll call them derivative,
right.
ethnic cuisines.
It looks
have gone
somewhat
to.
Like the original.
Yeah.
You know, what that reminds me of, you know, we took from the cannolis, we took our inspiration from, and I thought this was interesting, the cannolis that, you know, were in the corner bake shop around from your grandma's house mm-hmm. in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. where we went. But we went to Verona,
sure.
and I remember the best cannoli we've ever had.
It was spectacular.
Was on the streets in Verona that one time. We went to all the different pastry shops all around.
I can't lie to anybody. The cannolis we have at the restaurant aren't as good as the cannoli we had in Verona. I'll tell you the truth.
One day, Marky. but you know, it's seen through a lens, and I think that when you have a restaurant in America, yeah, it's a French restaurant or it's an Italian restaurant, but it's not really. It's not
mm-hmm.
the same, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't try to be. And I think it's really cool. Our guest is going to talk about Asian restaurants, and because you know, most of American culture is based on Western European cultures. Asian restaurants can seem very foreign, and of course, a lot of the Chinese.
I get it. Asian restaurants can seem very foreign.
Yeah, very foreign to us. In you know, tradition.
Like almost halfway across the world, foreign. Is that what you meant?
You know, you reminded me of. I remember when Bon Jovi first toured Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed, and they were interviewing him on the air, and on the MTV was interviewing him, and they said, "So, John, what's it like being over here in Russia?" And he paused for a moment, and he thought, he said, "Yeah, it's so different over here. It's almost like another country." It is another country, John.
More
country.
Pearls of wisdom from our own New Jersey's own John Bon Jovi.
But I guess my point is, I think it's wonderful to go and experience these other restaurants and other types of cuisine, but you're not getting the pure example of what it is. What I'll point to is we have a wonderful Ethiopian restaurant in New Brunswick. Mark and I often go to lunch. We'll often go. It's right around the corner.
And whenever we need to talk about something that we don't want our own employees to hear about, we sneak over to Makeda and have some Ethiopian.
That's a plug for Makeda, by the way. It's owned by some very nice people. But you know, the Ethiopian food is delicious, and they've explained the Ethiopian food to us, and it was opened by a Nigerian fellow when it first opened, a Nigerian fellow and an Ethiopian, another friend of ours, a guy named Tef, who was from Ethiopia. And so it was very authentic. The food's very authentic. But in Ethiopian food, you don't use silverware. You use a bread, basically a sourdough flatbread called injera, and you pick up the food with the bread and put that in your hands. And I'm over there, and we've been going for years. We love the place. But every time I'm over there, I'm thinking to myself, you know, in Ethiopia, I bet they can do this more neatly. I mean, I know that if I was sitting at someone's table in Ethiopia and they were watching me mess my face up with and my hands and everything with the food, they would think me quite rude. I don't know how to do it politely.
You know what else I know?
I don't know what's polite and what's not.
You know what else I know?
What?
That if I were in Ethiopia,
yeah,
they'd be like, he's going to eat all of that? Okay, I'm sure of that. Because those, obviously, culturally, that's very, very different. I mean, even
you know, it's almost every country in the world, almost no country eats as much as we do.
And certainly as much meat. I mean, we eat a tremendous, tremendous amount of meat.
But I think that's really wild because you go to, we've been all around Europe together and separately.
I'll tell you, just the counterpoint of that is, there are cultures where they do have giant meals, where they do have kind of those big celebration meals, of course.
But not every day.
Not every day, but and even the cultures, I mean, when I lived in France, there was a fairly big meal, a meal that we would consider, wow, that's a sizable meal. But it was always lunch.
Yeah.
It was never dinner. You always, if you were going to have a big meal, you had it at lunchtime. You didn't have it at nighttime. Nighttime was, you know, a small meal, a quail, something we would never do here.
Hey, you know, we're going to be talking with Alan Brown about his article on the differences in cultural perspective on Japanese cuisine and Japanese restaurants. But if this sort of thing fascinates you, I want to recommend a book that I've recommended maybe once or twice before. I recommend that you pick it up. It's called Manners, The Rites and Rituals of Dinner. And it's by a woman named Margaret Visser. We'll put that up on our website as well. You should check it out. It's a fascinating look at manners, at the development of our current manners, and a little bit of comparative study with manners of other cultures, and it's fascinating. It starts with a cannibalistic sacrifice of some conquistadors watched by their friends. They weren't too happy about that, and then ends with a state dinner in the White House. And it's absolutely fascinating how she ties it all together. But on a more contemporary note, we're going to be talking with Alan Brown about Kyoto in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, from Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Alan Brown. Alan is a novelist, a filmmaker, a writer, director. He's also a contributing editor at Travel and Leisure and a regular contributor to Gourmet, Bon Appetit, and other great food publications. He's written about and covered Japan extensively, and he joins us today to discuss his article from Gourmet magazine on the food of Kyoto.
Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, Alan, you have a lot of experience in Japan, and so you've made a lot of cultural and food observations of Japan. Why did you choose to write about Kyoto in particular?
Well, I didn't particularly choose Kyoto, but I was talking to Gourmet, and I was talking to Ruth, who's the editor-in-chief, of course,
former guest
about Japanese food. And we were having lunch, and I commented on the fact, as I do in the article, that when you go out for Japanese food in the United States, you expect to have everything on the menu. You're going to be with five people, and somebody wants sushi, and somebody wants tempura, and somebody wants a bowl of ramen. And Japanese restaurants in the States tend to cover all their bases. But in Japan, that idea is kind of a new one. Japanese restaurants tend to put more emphasis on specialization.
Well, I mean, that's just a function, I think, of the way we eat here in the United States. You know, everybody wants to sample from the buffet, as it were.
Of course,
As opposed to other places.
When we were talking about it, and Kyoto seemed like, I mean, that's true all over Japan, but Kyoto seemed like the place to set this article, since Kyoto is the city that's all about tradition and history.
Now, Kyoto was originally the capital of Japan, was it not?
It was.
And it was changed
when? The capital
when?
Moved to Edo, just centuries ago, but for the original capital was Kyoto.
And in the culture of the restaurants that you talk about, and in Japanese culture overall, you talk about these restaurants that make literally, specifically, one thing.
Yes.
Talk to us about, like, how that works, like what kind of restaurant that is, and what kind of one thing you might find at a restaurant.
Well, you would find almost, you know, a sushi restaurant in Japan only does sushi, and a tempura restaurant in Japan will only do tempura. But it's not just about the one thing they make. It's a continuity also within the family. And particularly in a place like Kyoto, a lot of these restaurants I write about go back 300, 400, 500 years. And it's not just that the restaurants have been around that long. They stay within one family. In fact, there is I write about a particular place in a buramochi place, which is really a little snack food out of pounded rice flour, and it's a very simple food, but this place I write about has been making it for, I don't know, 400 or 500 years, and they always joked when I would visit, there was a place just across the path from theirs that they had been making it for 250 years, so they were referred to as the newcomers, and you couldn't quite trust them to get it right at that point.
Well, you talk about in your article going to a new restaurant that is 50 years
right.
making, and that's a really new restaurant.
It is, indeed. For Kyoto, it is. I mean, they say in Kyoto that, you know, when you move to town there, that people don't really even start talking to you for the first 50 years or so because you're newcomers. But, you know, it's not just Kyoto. I mean, I remember I lived in Tokyo for almost 8 years, and there was a restaurant around the corner from my apartment that served only sardines. And they served sardines in every possible manifestation you can think of.
So what kind of ways did they serve them?
Well, you would, of course, have chopped sardine balls like meatballs, and you would have a sardine soup, and you would have soba with sardines, and you would have fried sardines and baked sardines and broiled sardines. And, you know, in that same way, when you go to an eel restaurant, you will have broiled eel, but also the soup will be a broth with the eel's liver in it. And you will also get fried eel bones, which are actually a great snack. They're like potato chips.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it came a lot from Japan's history. It is not a resource-rich country. It's a small island, and for a long time, Japan was quite poor. So they really learned to make the most of everything that they had. They don't waste a lot from a particular item.
Do you think that, I draw the contrast with American restaurants,
mm-hmm.
and I think the contrast is a cultural one overall that is expressed in food, but it is maybe runs a little deeper than that. And I see in our own culture, we're running away. I mean, from we can't even our the latest thing in the quick food sector of the restaurants is to combine them. So like if some big company owns both Kentucky Fried Chicken and TCBY yogurt and Dunkin' Donuts,
mm-hmm.
they'll open a store with those three fast food restaurants.
Right, so you can dip
exactly.
your donut in yogurt and put a little taco sauce on it before you go.
The American dream.
Is this sort of mania infecting Japan at all? Is Japan moving away from these traditional restaurants at all, or is it stable?
Oh, yes, indeed it is. I mean, those restaurants, particularly in a place, I was going to say in Kyoto, but really anywhere, they're valued, but young Japanese, of course, you have to realize it was just decades ago, really in the 1980s, that the Japanese started going abroad in large numbers. I mean, it really wasn't until the end of the 19th century that Japan even had contact with the outside world, but through most of the 20th century, the Japanese simply didn't travel. But once they did, there was like an insatiable taste for all things foreign. I mean, they have, you know, they're quite amusing over there about what they call their booms. There was the Italian food boom. There was the tiramisu boom, and I lived there. I lived through the tiramisu boom, which meant that tiramisu popped up on every menu, even at Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Mm. I bet that was delicious.
And there was tiramisu ice cream bars. And you know, I mean, the Japanese like variety as much of as Americans. The difference is there's not, and there is fusion food is all the rage over there now. I mean, but in terms of Japanese food itself, you know, the tradition still stands. You want a particular thing, you go to a restaurant that does that. And you also have to remember, in Japan, restaurants are tiny. They're the size of an American bathroom.
I actually want to talk a little bit about the differences in restaurants overall in the physical plan of the restaurant in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking today with Alan Brown. We're talking specifically about an article he wrote in Gourmet Magazine about Kyoto, but we're talking about Japanese cuisine and food culture in general compared to Americans. We were saying before the break, or you were saying, Alan, that Japanese restaurants are very, very small, generally, these one-shot restaurants.
Sure.
Is there a place in Japanese restauranting where entertaining happens like we have in our restaurants in the West?
Oh, absolutely. You mean like having a party at a restaurant or taking business clients out to eat?
Well, I mean, there are restaurants that have sort of woven their way. They say in New York City that, you know, one of the reasons of the New York City restaurant and bar scene has always been so lively is because space has always been at such a premium that people don't invite people over their house to entertain. They use their local tavern or their local restaurant as their living room. Is that the case in Japan at all?
I would say even more so in Japan, because people's home spaces are so tiny that in all the years I was there, I had very good friends, and I never saw the insides of their homes. And, you know, I live in Manhattan, and I'm in an apartment, but even here people have you over.
Mm-hmm.
But it rarely is done in Japan. More, you know, you'd almost always eat out. And so, you know, you have your neighborhood places. But yes, it serves the same function over there, absolutely. Although, you know, places tend to be a lot smaller. Restaurants in America have grown very theatrical, you know, in size and in presentation. Where really the ultimate thing in Japan you want, you don't want to go to this huge sushi palace. You want to go to that six-seat, you know, exclusive little sushi in the Ginza, where there aren't even any tables. It's just a tiny counter with six seats, and there's a chef behind the counter, you know, in a space the size of smaller than your closet, and you're getting all that personal attention, and you're getting everything fresh. You're watching him prepare it and give it to you. Same thing when you go for tempura in Japan. You wouldn't sit at a table. You could, but what you really want is the chef in front of you, you know, deep frying, you know, making those pieces piece by piece and handing you them just as they come out of the oil. So everything's completely fresh.
You know, I'll tell you, I probably do want some tables and a little more space than that, but I also have an aversion to going to the palace or the big box restaurant that's invading. Well, that's taking over New York.
I don't need a big restaurant. I just need a big chair.
We'll be back.
That's another problem. The difference between the Americans and the Japanese.
And our chairs in America are getting bigger all the time.
Yeah, they are.
We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Alan Brown, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Alan Brown is a novelist, filmmaker, writer, and director. He's a contributing editor at Travel and Leisure and a regular contributor to Gourmet Magazine, Bon Appetit, and other great food publications. And we're talking today about Japan, about which Alan has lived in Japan and covered it extensively. Alan, before the show, before the news, we were talking about how a restaurant in Kyoto, where you wrote this article in Gourmet Magazine, will stay in the same family for generations. You start the article talking about a restaurant called Ichiwa.
Mm-hmm.
And you had befriended the woman who was the proprietress of, that place. And when you go back to Japan, you oddly arrive after a long absence at the day of her funeral, your friend's funeral.
Yeah, I hadn't been there in 10 years.
And then shortly thereafter, her children are now running the place, and they're the 23rd generation in her family to run that specific restaurant.
Actually, they're the 24th.
She was Obachan, the
23rd. Granny was the 23rd, and she died. She was 94 when she died. So they're now taking over, but they're not spring chickens either. These women are, they're her daughter and daughter-in-law are, you know, in their 70s.
But there's obviously an expectation that you take over the restaurant from your parents, and that is what you must do.
There is indeed, and I've spoken to children of restaurant owners from families like these in Japan who've really felt the pressure and the obligation because, you know, these days, of course, things have changed. You'll get a lot of kids who want to go off, you know, move to Tokyo, move to another city, have another kind of career. But that kind of family pressure is a lot stronger in Japan than it is here, particularly if you have a restaurant that's been in the family for 500 years. You know,
that's an amazing thing to me. I had just to contrast it. I was at a seminar recently put on by the New Jersey Restaurant Association, and they talked about succession issues. And they talked about, okay, you've built this restaurant and you want to pass it on to your kids. Chances are that's not going to happen. What to do when if your kids don't want to take the restaurant on? And the idea of a family business in America, especially a restaurant, first of all, a restaurant surviving from one generation to the next, but passing it off is it's uncommon and it's celebrated because it's so unusual. Do you think this points to it, because your novel is set in Japan, you've lived in Japan for a long time, does this point to a larger cultural difference between America and Japan?
Sure, it does indeed. And I know particularly for an eldest or only child in Japan, that pressure, I mean, I would say till a generation ago, it wasn't even pressure. You were just automatically, you know, considered it was the duty of the eldest son or the only child to take over the family business. And I knew, you know, I had friends, many friends in Tokyo who went to, for instance, came to Tokyo from towns all over Japan and went to college, and no matter what their interests were, and of course they were as varied as any, you know, any nationality, the young people in any country, a lot of these kids I knew had to go back to their hometowns and take over their father's businesses.
You know, I find it amazing being, and we talk about American sensibilities versus Japanese sensibilities. You know, you have a 500-year-old restaurant. Here in the United States, if you find a 175-year-old Arrowhead, you build a museum.
Right.
Now, you know, it's funny. I also recall that when my dad was a fireman, civil servant, fire chief, actually.
Uh-huh.
He retired as fire chief. And I remember when I was about 13, he took me down to the headquarters station, the Orange Fire Department, where, you know, my dad was a big hero. He was the chief. And he put his arm on my shoulder, and we looked at the two engine companies that were headquartered at the headquarters station. And he said, "Son, all of this is not mine, so you better do well in school."
Well, you know, listen, I'm from, and I would rarely admit this on the air or even in public, I'm from Scranton, Pennsylvania.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. You guys loosened me up a lot. Don't worry. You know, I am my father worked, you know, my uncles, they all worked for their father. But when they got to our generation, none of us carried on the family businesses.
Yeah, I
none
did.
None of us were interested. We all left.
My sisters all worked for my dad, and I chose the other path.
Yeah, and by the way, in the restaurant business, you may forbid your children to take it over.
Exactly.
You know better.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
That's,
although I grew up, you know, we had some restaurants in our town where they really were on and still are, you know, the second and third generation. I remember the Bistokis, you know, they're, I knew the father, I knew the grandfather. They kept these restaurants going, you know. But that, you know, that's in a small town.
I'll tell you though, I have two different people working for me right now whose parents own restaurants, and you know, what they're trying to do is kind of broaden their frame of reference in order to go back to those restaurants and take them
right.
over. Sure.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. In the article, there's a restaurant I mentioned in their EQ, which is a very traditional. Kind of a Zen Buddhist restaurant, and they've been, it's outside the gates of Daitokuji Temple, and they've been cooking for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the daughter, there was no son, and she told me, it's not in the article, but she had tremendous pressure. She really had to marry a guy who then took the family name. She had to marry a guy who cooked.
Oh, because she needed to carry on?
Carry it on. And that's also not uncommon in Japan, for the daughter to marry a man who then takes on the family name.
I want to.
The traditions carried on that way.
You raised some other points about that restaurant, mm-hmm. and you said that, you know, when the father passed away, you had known the father's Hideo Tsuda, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter Masumi has taken it over.
She's the granddaughter, actually.
She's the okay.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Now, this restaurant, you say it's a Zen Buddhist restaurant, but I think a lot of people don't realize what that means. They've been making the same food with the same very limited set of ingredients set by the monks for how long?
For 500 years now.
And is this very common? I mean, does the food change at all, or is it identical time after time?
Well, it's not. What they have is, what doesn't change are the very severe restrictions on what they're allowed to use and what they're allowed to cook. And interestingly, I mean, you talk about the local food movement, or, you know, they really use all things that, well, of course, they ban beings and Buddhists. This is very strict. So they ban the meat, eggs, dairy. They don't have any strong spices or herbs that they use. I mean, they don't use garlic or onions. And they use really local vegetables. But what they do with them, you know, it's that Japanese talent of really having those limitations in creating the most stunningly beautiful food. I mean, and a lot of where the notion of Japanese food being a lot for the eye as much as for the mouth or the stomach, that so much is in the presentation, really comes from this tradition in Japan. Again, it's not a resource-rich country, and for a long time, you know, people didn't eat meat there.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't, even the poor people, inland people, didn't have access to fish. They were eating vegetables. They were eating root vegetables. And what they learned to do with these things, where, you know, what the gorgeous, you've been to kaiseki meal.
Mm-hmm.
You get course after course like this. And even kaiseki meals are really, you know, strictly presented, you know, what course follows what course is all decided ahead of time.
Now,
you don't really vary that.
Will you share with us how, you know, I think when Americans go to Europe, I think it's mm-hmm. Americans of European descent go to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of easy. I think it's easier to.
There is a frame of reference.
Sure, of course.
There's a frame of reference, and it's easier to adopt and understand the culture and to sort of fit in and start modifying your behavior and your sense of protocol.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to Japan, and how difficult was it as a Westerner to try and, you know, obviously right now you're very conversant and comfortable mm-hmm. in Japanese society. Why'd you go there, and how did you fit in?
I went actually on a Fulbright in journalism, and I went for a year, and I had never lived abroad, although I traveled in Europe, but I had not traveled, I hadn't traveled in Japan. So I thought that in a year I would become fluent in the language and penetrate the culture and all of those things. And of course, you realize when you're moving to a country as foreign as Japan or any other country, really, I would say it probably holds true even for England, that in a year you're just kind of psychologically, emotionally still unpacking.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept staying on and on and on. And what for me the trick was, and I think Japanese culture in terms of their mores and manners really is quite different than ours. And we don't have a lot of frame of reference for what we automatically, you know, we can make a lot of assumptions here, even about what's right or wrong or good or bad. But it's, you know, it's different in Asia.
Well, and you think about the traditions that we have are a century old, or maybe two centuries old, and the traditions that they have are thousands of years old.
Right, but there are also a lot of them, you know, these, our traditions butt up against theirs. Ours are about, you know, expressing your feelings and individualism and you know, the individual above the group. And that's totally the opposite of how the Japanese feel. So, you know, we have a habit as Westerners of going, of kind of blundering in every situation over there. And I think the trick that I discovered, in answer to your question about how, what it was like to adjust and fit in, is it took me about a year, and then after a year I realized that I was not Japanese. I would never be Japanese. They expected me to make mistakes and to blunder, and that's when I relaxed.
I want to. We have to take a quick break for a commercial, but I want to come back and talk to you about what it's like to be a foreigner in a foreign land and what kind of trouble you can get yourself into.
Lots.
We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Alan Brown, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Here's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking with Alan Brown. Alan, we were talking before the break, if anyone's just tuned in, about Japan. Alan's written about Japan extensively and written novels set in Japan as well. I found that, you know, the first time I went to Europe, I blundered in a few situations.
I found the first 8 times I went to Europe, I blundered in a few situations.
You know, I found, you know, even, and I'm Irish-American, in Ireland, you know, I blundered a few times.
Sure.
Or I've watched people blunder a few times. Like, you don't pour the whiskey at another man's table. He pours, and if your glass stays empty a long time, it means go home. Whereas in my house, you're like, here's a bottle of whiskey,
right,
pour it yourself.
Right,
I'm not going to pour
right.
it for you. So, but you go to Japan on a Fulbright. Did you find, where did you find that you really did blunder? Did you have any?
Oh, God, everywhere.
So give us an example. Yeah. It's radio. We want to be entertaining.
It's the simplest thing. I mean, there's a Japanese expression, you know, you're always meeting people and they say, asobi ni kite kudasai. It means, please come and visit. And I actually believe them. I didn't realize that it was just an expression. Everybody says that. And nobody wants you to come and visit them.
Oh, really?
You know, you blunder because, first of all, there's this crazy ritual of, you know, shoes and slippers and no slippers. You know, you walk into anywhere, someplace, you take off your shoes, you put on slippers. But then you walk down the hall and you walk into the tatami room. And this holds true for many restaurants. And, you know, try this when you're drunk because, you know, the Japanese drink a lot.
Uh-huh.
So then you take off the slippers when you get into the tatami. So in the tatami room, you don't have slippers on at all. But then you have to go to the bathroom because you've been drinking a lot. So you get off the tatami, you put the slippers back on. But when you get to the bathroom, there's a separate pair of bathroom slippers. So you take off the hall slippers and put on the bathroom slippers. And invariably, of course, particularly half drunk, I would stumble back into the restaurant part in our tatami room, not only in slippers, but in the bathroom slippers, which are usually like green plastic and have a cute little picture of a little baby peeing on them or something.
Oh, you know.
It all sounds very sanitary, except for the part where you put on somebody else's slippers.
Right. Well, it's sanitary. But another thing is bathrooms in Japan never have dryers, hand dryers, or paper towels, because Japanese always carry handkerchiefs with them, which they use for that purpose. And indeed, you never blow your nose at the table, which, of course, I always did, being in, you know, a crude American. But yeah, it's impossible not to blunder there. You know, yeah, you stick your chopsticks in your rice, you know, just leave them there standing up, and someone will, you know, discreetly tell you that that is something to do with Japanese funerals.
Oh,
that's excellent. Yeah, it's going to take away the appetite.
You saved me a blunder right there.
Right.
Now, I found myself cursing at people by accident was what I was doing. Just you know, repeating some phrase or another that I had heard and
getting it slightly wrong.
And getting it slightly wrong, exactly.
Talk to us, Alan, about your novel, Audrey Hepburn's Neck.
Well, Audrey Hepburn's Neck, which is to plug it is available, still out there, Washington Square Press.
And I'll help you plug it. I'll help you plug it even further. If you want to pick it up, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll link you right to it.
Exactly.
So tell us about Audrey Hepburn's neck.
It's set in Tokyo, and it's about a young Japanese man named Toshi Okamoto, who it's set in contemporary Tokyo, who is obsessed with Japanese women. I mean, with American women, excuse me, with Audrey Hepburn. He was raised by a mother who took him to see Audrey Hepburn's movies. So he only dates American women. And so it's really, oddly, it's kind of a reversed, it's a look at Americans through Japanese eyes. So what I explored, because I felt living in Japan, one of the things, and people always ask, what did you learn about Japan? You were there for 8 years. What I really learned the most about was being an American, because I spent long enough in this culture that I could see Americans through the eyes of the Japanese, or, you know, well enough to write this book. And so it's about all these cross-cultural misunderstandings, because invariably he ends up dating women who, you know, if you, as an American, you would look at this character and you'd go, uh-oh, trouble.
Uh-huh.
The moment she comes walking down the street. But all those signs that we read so easily as trouble, he would read as exotic.
Or intriguing.
Or
he can't
see it.
Right. And it's so the novel's set in the contemporary times, but it also refers back, because of his parents' story, it refers back to World War II. And again, it has to do with cultures and Japan's relationship with Korea and America. It's hard to plug my own book and tell you that it's wonderful, but you should go out and read it.
You know, I think it's an interesting point that the premise of it is interesting in a lot of ways, because I've always pointed to, and we have a lot of young people that work for us or have come through our lives working in the restaurant business, and I always say to people, you should travel when you're young.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference between travel and tourism. Because travel always holds out the possibility that you might stay.
Yeah.
And when you can go into another culture, even if it's unlikely, with that open end, you learn, it's not as, you learn about that culture, but you also learn about your own culture.
But and the word that I couldn't keep thinking about while you were talking there, Alan, is perspective.
Yeah.
What you learn is you learn some perspective, and perspective is not just what's happening to you, but how you're being perceived while that's happening to you.
And perspective is something we could all use. Certainly Americans could use out in the world.
Let's not go there. That's a different show.
No, we won't. But I do want to say I agree with you. And when I meet young kids, like in college or just getting out of college, the one piece of advice I give them is, go live somewhere. Mm-hmm. Go to another country and live there for a couple of years. It will change who you are and how you perceive yourself in the world.
And the one piece of advice we'll give you is to go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You can find out about Audrey Hepburn's neck. We'll also link you to the article in Gourmet, one of our favorite magazines, on Kyoto's never-changing dining scene. Alan, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants.
You know, early on in the show, I couldn't help thinking he was talking about how you go to an eel restaurant in Japan, or you go to a tempura restaurant in Japan, or a sushi restaurant in Japan, and they're very, very specialized in how here in the United States we kind of have the buffet mentality, and, you know, I want to be able to get my fish and chips or my Big Mac or my hot apple pie or whatever. And I just, thinking back to my college days, I was working in a restaurant that closed at about 11 or 12, and there was a restaurant, I'll give the name of the restaurant, and no longer exists, called Bucky's. And Bucky's served Chinese, Italian, and American food.
And none of it well.
So you could go get a pizza, some French fries, some spare ribs and an egg roll.
You can go to Baumgart's Cafe in Livingston, New Jersey. I think it's a chain. I'm not sure. But you can go to Baumgart's Cafe, and my family ate there recently, and you could get sushi or a hamburger. or pasta.
Could you get a raw hamburger?
No, you get sushi. No, maybe. that'd be a concept. But you get sushi or a hamburger or pasta, and, you know,
Were you impressed by the place?
My 83-year-old mother went with my sister. And it was not a rave review.
She didn't come back? She came back ranting, not raving?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, convenient and quality are often at odds.
Right.
And
here's my rule. if the whole cooking instructions are put in the microwave, it's probably not going to be good.
Okay. But the other thing is it also shows you that there's no passion for any one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If the menu comes from a market study of what the people around want to
right.
eat, and then there's a market study of the cheapest way to get the minimum level of quality to get people to
and
eat it.
And what colors are going to get you to eat more when you come into the dining room?
You're going to get that quality of food.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I say, restaurants are the last bastion. Individually owned restaurants are the last bastion of mom and pops. The work of, and I think one of the reasons people are so drawn to chefs and culinary schools is because it is still an individual craft, and thank God for that. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.